This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That's the day that we ask reporters from local media to talk about the stories that have been print and online recently. And from the Times of Northwest Indiana, we have Dan Carden, who's his official title is Chief Political Reporter. But he's not afraid to cover, I think, any story that's out there within Northwest Indiana. That seems to be the case, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, I think everybody at every newspaper is kind of a jack of all trades.
I know. But the major things that you cover typically focus, of course, on the General Assembly, which will be very busy in the weeks ahead. And, of course, local government in particular. In fact, most of your stories here recently, and as recently as today, talks about, I guess, what you could call the palace intrigue that happens within that building in Crown Point, which is called the Lake County Government Center. And bring us up to date, if you will, may have to do a little primer first as to what the problems seem to be, but what the latest in the palace intrigue seems to be.
Yeah, it's both incredibly complicated and amazingly simple. When you come right down to it, it's a power struggle between the Lake County Council and the Lake County Commissioners. The council is Lake County's legislative body. They set the budget. They oversee spending. But the commissioners, which is the executive body for Lake County, actually does the spending. There's a push within the council to basically take control of government purchasing away from the commissioners, which, you know, as everybody believes, has always had it. Mm-hmm. But the council has found this obscure statute from 1981 that seems to give them the power to do it. So they've been trying to take this power away from the commissioners. And it started out sort of as a war of words, and then the council recently filed a lawsuit trying to take this power away. So that's pending in court. And all of this centers on spending requests by the Lake County Sheriff. So the council has funded these things that the sheriff wants, but the commissioners have been reluctant to go ahead and purchase these items because they don't think the sheriff actually needs them, or that the sheriff hasn't done a good enough job explaining why he needs them. And it's a whole bunch of stuff. The sheriff is asking for a new boat for water rescues, an automotive lift to repair cars, a new police vehicle, all-terrain vehicles, a drone, a bunch of flashlights, a bunch of high-tech vehicle antennas, and even 30 office chairs. So the commissioners have declined to go ahead with those purchases, which has inspired the council to try and sort of take the power away from the commissioners to go ahead and help the sheriff. And it's been this ongoing thing over the past several months. So like I said, we've got the lawsuit. The sheriff has accused the commissioners of not caring about public safety. The commissioners say they're just concerned about, you know, spending taxpayer dollars wisely. The council says, you know, we're the ones that make the decisions about the money, and we said to go ahead and spend the money, so the commissioners should just go ahead and do it. And now this just keeps going on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the latest thing now is actually it's a pandemic-related issue, isn't it? It's something that you, if you happen to go to the Hammond Clinic, we'll say, just to pick one to be sure, you go in and you get checked out for your temperature to make sure that you're not coming down or you don't already have the virus so that you would spread it inside the building. So putting up thermometers is I guess, the latest issue that's come up now. This is what I understand the Sheriff's Department wants?
Yeah, and I think that the council picked this because it is, you know, tied to the pandemic. The sheriff would like to install these body temperature kiosks. You see them in some public places. The casinos all have them, too, sort of right. These freestanding kiosks you have to pass through to go in. So he wants to put them at his offices in the Lake County Jail because he thinks that's necessary to prevent the spread of COVID-19. And I think, you know, the council recognized the sympathetic nature of that argument and used that in particular to sort of trigger the latest fight with the commissioners, where after the commissioners said the sheriff couldn't get them, the council said, okay, well, we'll just buy them. And now council's even trying to bypass the commissioners on even doing the purchase because they claim that it doesn't need to be done in the normal way. But that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so this is the latest argument of these things. The commissioners are saying, you know, look, this pandemic is in theory almost over. Are we going to spend $25,000 for these thermometers to get shoved in a closet in June and never used again? And they've also pointed out that the sheriff doesn't have a policy on how they're going to be used. I mean, is it going to be they don't let you in the building at 101 degrees? Is it 99.9 degrees? You know, the commissioners have been asking for more information, and the sheriff says he's trying to get it to them, mm-hmm. and that the commissioners aren't listening. The commissioners saying the sheriff isn't as being as forthcoming as he's claiming, and the council basically is standing with the sheriff in this dispute. So, things. Yeah. We'll see what happens next.
Well, it looks like now the next couple of stories are a bit more straightforward. They are certainly not involving the local government in a way, but they are involving a government. In this case, first off, the fact that they were going to probably end up having a new U.S. Attorney for Northwest Indiana take over because the current occupant of the office is going to get kicked upstairs, so to speak. He's getting promoted to Chicago. Tell us what U.S. Attorney Thomas Kearse is going to be doing now that he has a confirmation from the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, and pretty much in any presidential administration change between parties, you'd get a new U.S. Attorney anyway, but our current U.S. Attorney Thomas Kearse is, like you said, ending up in probably a better position than getting fired by the next administration. He just got confirmed. He was nominated by President Trump. He just got confirmed by the U.S. Senate on Tuesday to become a federal appeals court judge. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago has a vacancy that was created when Amy Coney Barrett got put on the U.S. Supreme Court. So the president nominated Kearse for Barrett's seat on the appeals court. The Senate reviewed his nomination and voted 51-44 to confirm him. So in the next couple of days, presumably, Kearse will resign as U.S. attorney and take up his commission as a federal judge. It's a good gig, too, because, you know, federal judges serve for the rest of their lives. So, or they can serve for the rest of their lives. So at 46 years old, Kearse has, at least 20 years of job security in front of him if he wants it.
Well, he's certainly well-known here in Northwest Indiana for all that he has done to fight crime, and in particular about organized crime and the drug trafficking that unfortunately we are kind of home to here because we happen to be in this corner of the state and with Illinois next door. So it's probably going to be a loss, I'm sure, certainly to the law enforcement community, although I know there are other people that are just as qualified that are in his office that are probably going to be able to take over very handily, at least as the U.S. attorney.
Right. And when President-elect Biden takes office, he will nominate somebody. And, you know, one of the good things about Kearse is he lives in Schererville, so he knows Northwest Indiana. He understands the region. But, you know, this position is for the entire northern district of Indiana. So, you know, it could be somebody from Fort Wayne or South Bend or somewhere like that as well who gets into that. On the other hand, we'll have a Schererville resident on the Seventh Circuit. So a lot of cases from Indiana actually end up at the Seventh Circuit because, let's say, charitably, the General Assembly tends to pass a lot of unconstitutional legislation that has to end up in federal court.
So he had to get to see these matters when they come up on appeal, I'm sure. They'll be there.
Right.
He's not going to completely forget about us here in Northwest Indiana.
Right, definitely. And he'll have the kind of sort of understanding of Indiana politics and government that will be helpful for adjudicating these disputes. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of Northwest Indiana lawmakers, in fact, we think with the General Assembly getting underway here after the new year begins, we're going to have names from Northwest Indiana that will be very, very prominent in maybe making some serious policy decisions coming up. Tell us more about that story, please.
Yeah. So both houses of the General Assembly are controlled by Republicans, the House and the Senate. The Republicans have supermajorities in both chambers. They actually grew their supermajority in the House this year. And that means sort of long-serving Republican legislators have a chance to lead a committee where all the bills on a particular subject are assigned so they can get reviewed and fixed before the full chamber decides whether or not to vote on them and advance them to the other chamber or send them to the governor to be made into law. So several Northwest Indiana Republican lawmakers are going to be committee chairmen in the upcoming session, including Representative Ed Saladay from Valparaiso. He's going to remain as chairman of the Utilities, Energy, and Telecommunications Committee, and he's been overseeing a multi-year review of the state's energy policy. As you know, Indiana has long been a coal state, and as coal has become more expensive and sort of less favored given the pollution aspects of it compared to renewable resources, there's been a real push within the General Assembly of how fast does Indiana move toward renewables versus, you know, maintaining the coal jobs and coal, you know, businesses, coal communities that are important to the southern corner of the state. So you got Saladay on utilities. Representative Jim Pressel is going to be the new chairman of the House Roads and Transportation Committee. This is actually a committee Saladay used to lead, and this panel oversees the road funding legislation, trains, a lot of issues relating to roads. Representative Pressel was one of the advocates for the handheld mobile device ban that passed last year. So you might see a lot more safety-type legislation coming out of the General Assembly under his watch on that committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Senate, State Senator Ed Charbonneau, also from Valparaiso, is chairman of the Health Committee, which in a global pandemic is an important place to be.
I'm sure that's probably something in particular, and having to deal with all of the changes that will have to come about here because of the pandemic. At least it's starting in a new year, but there's still going to be problems because the pandemic, I'm sure, is still going to linger on. So it'll be interesting to see what Senator Charbonneau has to say. And we've had, as you mentioned earlier, that there have been some changes in lawmakers here in Northwest Indiana, some people returning to the State House, and one of them in particular, I guess, got reassigned to kind of an old seat on a committee, too, I understand. That's what that's where Representative Hal Slager comes into the picture.
Yeah, Hal Slager lost his seat in 2018. He represented Cherville, Dyer, that sort of area in Lake County. He lost his seat to Chris Chung in 2018. They had a rematch this year, and Representative Slager got it back. And House Speaker Todd Houston decided to put Slager right back on the House Ways and Means Committee, where he had been serving for the 6 years before that he was in the House. And that's an important place to be, especially in the majority, because the Ways and Means Committee helps craft the state budget. All spending tax legislation has to start in the House, so that House Ways and Means Committee will be the first place that the governor's proposed budget is evaluated and changed. And, that's a place where Northwest Indiana is going to want to have representation. State Representative Earl Harris, a Democrat from East Chicago, is on that committee. But having someone in the majority, can help ensure that, mm-hmm. Money and other projects end up getting steered up here as opposed to Indianapolis or somewhere downstate.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for spending time going over the stories that you have in print and online out there. We appreciate it, and we'll have you back on again soon. And certainly we'll have you back on here at the start of the new year here as we get ready for another General Assembly session. Thanks for today.
January 4th. Can't wait.
That's right. That's true. This, regionally speaking, is Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's talk now with Joe Pete, who covers business and related topics for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And, Joe, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've had some great stories that have come out in print and online here, and let's jump right in. Talk about the latest involving how Northwest Indiana jobs are doing here. We've had a pretty big loss here, but apparently it's being offset by more people moving into the region, it looks like.
Oh, yes. There was a recent economic study that the region had, obviously the coronavirus has greatly disrupted the economy and daily life across the entire world, not just our country and not just Northwest Indiana. But when the coronavirus induced recession was at its worst, Northwest Indiana lost a record 30,000 jobs in April in a single month, which accounted for more than 10.7% of all employment in the Calumet region. And Indiana University study found by IUN professor Michael Pollack, the unemployment rate was 60% higher during the worst of the COVID-19 crisis than it had ever previously been in Northwest Indiana. And we've had, you know, it was obviously, we've since managed to recover a lot of those jobs. A lot of the job losses were temporary. Restaurants, you know, and bars and nightclubs and so forth were forced to close. They've since brought people back. You know, some of that employment is only supposed to be like 70% in the hospitality and restaurant industry currently. People are still working reduced hours. You know, people are still very much hurting, but it's not as bad as it had been during the peak. A lot of the steel workers along the mills had been furloughed temporarily when all the orders plunged and they closed the auto plants. Most of them have been recalled at this point. You know, unemployment has been rebounding. But one thing that they were noting, in addition to despite the, you know, job losses we've suffered this year, there's a positive underlying trend in Northwest Indiana that we really haven't seen in some time. We're finally starting to gain population again for the first time in decades. In Porter County has been, you know, gaining population for a while now, but Lake has been steadily losing population. That trend, however, has been reversed over the past couple of years. In 2018, the Gary Metro, that, you know, Lake, Porter, Newton, Jasper, gained a total of 787 residents, it was estimated. Likely a lot of it, the migration from Illinois, you know, the south suburbs especially, and the south side of Chicago. And then last year we had a net gain of 2,012 more people moved to Northwest Indiana and moved away. And then that, you know, that was pretty much held as a pretty good sign where more people want to live in Northwest Indiana than want to leave. Because you can look at, you know, all these different economic metrics like GDP and income and so forth. But if people are actually moving here, that's a very good sign. It's been a concerted effort by a lot of different groups. You had the South Shore Convention of Visitors Authorities Move to Indiana campaign. You've had, it's been a goal in the Northwest Indiana Forum to ignite the region. There's, of course, been the effort to expand the South Shore line, to get more people who are commuting to Chicago to move here. So it's been like an ongoing effort by a number of groups across Northwest Indiana, because it's been a big issue. Because like a lot of communities in the so-called Rust Belt, you know, we've had a lot of deindustrialization. You know, the mills don't employ 30,000 people each anymore. We just don't have that kind of industrial employment. So we have to do something else to draw people. And it seems like we're finally gaining population again, which is very good news for the region.
Mm-hmm. Does it look like that because of the fact that we've had some job returns because of was it early on because of the first effects of the pandemic, the lockdowns that had happened early and back in spring? And we've seen unemployment rates drop here in Northwest Indiana, too. In fact, that's another of your stories. It's all related to the pandemic, although we still have some problem areas, some communities that still are pretty hurting, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately, we still have double-digit unemployment, especially in North Lake County, in Gary and East Chicago in particular. The unemployment is pretty high. It's been pretty high in Michigan City, Hammond, and so forth. But it's still 14% unemployment in Gary and 11% in East Chicago. However, you know, also, too, we're among the highest joblessness in the Hoosier State. Lake County was number two last month in unemployment, and LaPorte County was four. Even Porter County, which did relatively better, was 18th out of Indiana's 92 counties. So, you know, we have a lot of industrial jobs here and a lot of service industry jobs. And, you know, industrial jobs tend to be cyclical. It's very easy for them to, you know, cut a shift or, you know, downsized. And then a lot of the retail and hospitality jobs really been suffering during the pandemic. But overall, the job market does seem to be improving. If the local unemployment rate fell to 6.3%, it was as much as one out of five people in Northwest Indiana were unemployed in April. But it's been steadily, you know, steadily falling since then. The numbers are looking pretty good. Generally, we still have the pockets of high unemployment, but you know, it's getting to be, it's back under like 5% in some communities, including Cherryville, Valparaiso, and Crown Point.
I know that you spend a lot of time researching, although a lot of this I know is because you're a history buff, so you know very well the Northwest Indiana history, but you had a chance to put out in some very lengthy and very interesting articles here recently in the Times about the changeover in ownership for the, was it one time known as Inland Steel and picked up other names most recently, ArcelorMittal, and in this case, ArcelorMittal USA, which is changing owners to Cleveland Cliffs. Tell us a little more about Cleveland Cliffs. tips for people that are not familiar with this company, since it is based in Ohio, but they're starting to make a presence elsewhere here in the Midwest, obviously?
Oh, absolutely. Well, Cleveland-Cliffs is a pretty well-established company. They're a pretty well-established company. They've been around since, I want to say like 1847, somewhere in the mid-19th century. But they have historically been pretty much working in, or they've been around for 173 years. But historically, they've been based in mining. It's a mining company. They specialize in iron ore. It's where most of the iron ore for our steel mills comes from. They've already, you know, they already kind of had a presence in Northwest Indiana. They had a long-term, like 20-year contract or something to supply ArcelorMittal USA steel mills in along the lakeshore with iron ore from, you know, the Iron Range in Minnesota. And, you know, they're shipped across the lake freighters across Lake Michigan to us. And they basically are now buying their customer and buying ArcelorMittal because they've had the new CEO. He's pulled off a pretty ambitious effort to consolidate the steel industry in North America in a way that really hasn't been seen since all the bankruptcies and company failures in the early 2000s during the import crisis of that era. Cleveland-Cliffs ended up buying AK Steel for $1.1 billion. They're kind of based in the Dayton, Cincinnati area down in Ohio. And then after that, they purchased ArcelorMittal for $1.4 billion in stock and cash. They ended up also buying out the Nippon Steel shares in the Iontech and the finishing facilities in New Carlisle, Iontech and Cody that they get shipped steel coil by train that's made in East Chicago daily, and they finish it over there. But they're buying out pretty much most of ArcelorMittal's USA's assets, with the exception of the R&D center in East Chicago and a mini mill that has an electric arc furnace now in Calvert, Alabama, to serve the southern automakers down there. They still will get some steel from our mills here in Northwest Indiana. But they pulled off this very ambitious attempt to consolidate the steel industry. Now we only have two integrated producers left, U.S. Steel and Cleveland-Cliffs. Cleveland-Cliffs didn't really make any steel before 2020, which could be a cause for concern, but they've been very deeply involved in the steel industry. Anyone familiar with the blast furnace knows, you know, you can't really make new steel, first it's pig iron, but you can't make, pig iron in a blast furnace without iron ore. It's one of the most crucial raw ingredients, so they've been, you know, it's been a company working in the steel industry for more than 170 years, so they've got some longevity. And they're saying, you know, this move makes sense because they'll be able to have a much more friendly cost structure. You know, part of the thing that the steel industry has struggled with and why they've been so difficult is two things. They rely, integrated mills that we have here, they rely heavily on the automotive business. And the automakers have been able to kind of keep the price down for some time. They're very demanding on the specification of the product. They're kind of difficult customers to work with. And then with only two integrated steelmakers left, there's going to be a lot more leverage on the part of both U.S. Steel and Cleveland-Cliffs. They're going to have a lot more negotiating power, be able to achieve like better prices. And then the other issue is that when steel prices go up, as they have been lately, they've been way up since since reaching a nadir in March or April, you know, during the depth of the coronavirus crisis, when steel prices go up, the price of scrap goes up, the price of all the inputs, iron ore, you know, limestone, all that, it all starts to increase. So it bites into the profitability. You know, times are good, but they're not able to capitalize off of it as much as they should. And then also, you know, they have these long-term contracts. You know, a lot of it is spot prices, but then they have these long-term contracts set in so that when the times are booming, they haven't been able to kind of, you know, fully benefit from it the way they should. The Cleveland-Cliffs is going to go back to being fully integrated the way steel mills used to. You know, they're saying our input costs aren't going to really change for the iron ore we're supplying. And then so the steel makers aren't going to suffer from those wild, you know, or the mills that they're running aren't going to suffer because of the wild fluctuations in price that you've seen. And then the profits being eaten away by like rising input costs every time, you know, the market kind of starts to rebound. So they're hopeful that, you know, they're going to be able to run the mills in Northwest Indiana you know, the former Inland Steel Mill in East Chicago, the former LTV Steel Mill in East Chicago, the Burns Harbor Mill in Porter County, the Riverdale, hot strip mill just across the state line in Illinois, and Ion Tech and Ion Cody in New Carlisle. They're hoping that they're going to be able to run them more efficiently and profitably than ArcelorMittal USA was able to. So hopefully it's a good, the union, the USW union is pretty pleased with the deal. They've had good success working with Cleveland-Cliffs in the past. The last time there was a big negotiation in 2018, they were the first company that reached an agreement with the steel workers. They said they hadn't demanded any reasonable concessions. They paid them fairly. Cleveland-Cliffs brags about having the highest pay in the industry. They've already kind of won over some people because the big fear when this was happening was, you know, people might lose their pensions. We actually, Northwest Indiana now, and have for a while, have had a lot more retired steelworkers than we do, you know, current steelworkers. And Cleveland-Cliffs has agreed to take on all the pensions from ArcelorMittal. So, the retired steelworkers aren't going to be left out in the lurch. And, but it's the dawn of it's a historic moment for Northwest Indiana. It's the dawn of a new day. It's the first new ownership we've had along half of the mills since in more than 15 years. It's it'll be interesting to kind of to see what happens next, I guess.
Well, Joey knows here, too, that one of the other stories that you've had, not only in print and online recently, is a story you've covered in other ways in the past. For many, many years, people would travel on the Indiana Toll Road. They would go past on their way into Chicago, or at least south side of Chicago, go past the old state line generating station, see the big smokestacks there when they used to generate electricity from coal. But now, of course, there's nothing there except the Art Deco building, but there's now something that is probably not quite as tall as a smokestack. It's a flagpole. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. The Hammond Data Center, the Digital Crossroads, they had finally opened along the lakefront. The project has been planned for a couple of years now. It's come to fruition. They've opened this. It's kind of almost a modernization of, you know, like you mentioned, we used to have the smokestacks. We have the largest inland oil refinery in the United States. We have steel mills. We've got all this old historic industry, most of it dating back almost a century or more. They were making kerosene at the BP Whiting refinery originally. Mm-hmm. But now we have new investment coming in where you have a data center where they're using the lake water to cool the servers, to store data for credit card transactions, for backup streaming, to do all kinds of different, you know, all companies just demand an increasing amount of data in our modern digitized world. And one big thing, they were going to originally put out the largest Indiana flag in the state was originally the goal, to kind of put it the state line to kind of mark, hey, we've got this big new investment here. They ended up settling on doing a 164-foot flagpole with a massive American flag. They're saying it's one of the largest. It was what they were able to obtain. It would be the second largest flagpole in the state. There's one in Fort Wayne that's actually larger. If you've ever seen one of these, I saw one in Boise once, where it's one of the biggest flagpoles I've ever seen. It can be kind of, impressive in its scope and stature, but it's supposed to be the largest one in the Chicago metropolitan area and the largest in Northwest Indiana, and it's to honor veterans and symbolize the achievements through a project that's hoped to be transformative to help bring kind of more high-tech investment here. One good thing about this project is that it's connecting servers to dark fiber, but they're hoping it could potentially spur some more, you know, tech investment in the area and kind of, you know, diversify the economy and kind of modernize our image a little bit.
Well, Joe, we have about a minute left. Let's catch up on the latest here involving the brewing scene here in Northwest Indiana, and unfortunately it's more bad news. Tell us about Three Floyds Brewery.
Oh, it's almost unthinkable. One of the kind of the Three Floyds, just such an iconic brewery. They're going to continue to make beer, but they're going to, you know, it's been rated some of the best beer in the world. It's very widely acclaimed. Dark Lord Day draws thousands of people from all over the world to Northwest Indiana. But they're closing their brew pub. It was widely considered one of the finest like restaurants in Northwest Indiana. It's probably the only place in Northwest Indiana history that's been nominated for a James Beard Award. It was a semi-finalist for at least three straight years. That's like very prestigious. That's like the Oscars or Academy Awards of the restaurant scene. They were very acclaimed for their cuisine. it was elevated pub fare, but it was always changing. They had, you know, the ramen, beef pho, smoked chicken, cheese curds, all kinds of, but it was very chef driven, and it was a destination. People would bike down from Chicago to go dine there.
Wow.
And people would make a stop, you know, people going from Indy to Chicago would always make a point of stopping there to eat. It was always busy during kind of the peak dining hours, but unfortunately it's been a victim of the coronavirus pandemic. It's been closed since the thing started in March, and they just informed investors that on December 1st they made a decision to permanently close it. They're going to keep brewing beer. They're going to continue to offer both beer and food curbside, but it was truly an inspiration to an entire generation of craft brewers in Northwest Indiana. You have more than 24 breweries today. Many of them were inspired by, like, Windmill and Dyer, the Incognito in Merrillville, right by your office there. That guy's got a tattoo of the Three Floyds logo on his forearm. Or not Incognito, I'm sorry, the new one, Viking Artist Nails. But it's inspired so many brewers. And it dates back to 1996, the brewery, and it turned on so many people in Northwest Indiana to craft beer. It was truly like a proselytizer and evangelist for, you know, the craft beer scene that, you know, has since, like, hugely blew up across the region and the nation. And it's just a lot of people are just kind of in shock and mourning.
Joe, you know, we're going to we'll have to spend another conversation just talking about the breweries here in the region. We're out of time for today, but thank you very much for going through your stories. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Joe Speed is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking. From time to time, we have an opportunity to catch up with what's happening in the city of Hammond from the man who is the mayor of Hammond, Tom McDermott Jr., and he's with us from an undisclosed location. Well, actually, you're just out and around. We know that because you're out in the on the cell phone a lot in the community, and that's where you're checking in from today, and we appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thanks, Chris. Nice talking to you. I'm actually right next to the Hammond Data Center as we speak.
Well, good.
Checking out the progress.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. That's one of the things I have on my little list here. And one of the things, in particular, we're all concerned about is how things are situated with the city of Hammond as far as the pandemic is concerned. What's the latest that residents and city officials are dealing with COVID-19?
Well, we're, you know, Lake County is all in the red. The Lake County Health Department has placed restrictions on capacity gatherings in restaurants and bars. You know, restrictions on hours, maximum occupancy limits, and we're following them. Outside of the Hammond Sportsplex, in which we submitted a safety plan to the Lake County Health Department that was approved, and we're enforcing the safety plan strictly. But the Sportsplex still remains open with capacity limitations that were approved by the Lake County Health Department. So, of course, there's a lot of people that are being, you know, very disciplined about COVID and basically just staying at home. And I have all due respect to them. And you see other people that are more comfortable going out and, you know, going to restaurants and things and still wearing their mask and social distancing, and all due respect to them. And there's some people that want to play basketball, and there's some people that want to, like, jog, you know, walk around a track and jog around an indoor track. And we're trying to be accommodative to as many people as possible. But, of course, we're not being dangerous. We're following protocol set by the health department strictly.
Are there any things in particular that have been brought up recently? I know the city of Hammond has a specific COVID-19 task force. In fact, I think they had a recent meeting, I understand. Would anything come up that was brought up by some of the task force members in how they're trying to help the city deal with this?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, Chris. And we had the task force. We met weekly during the initial lockdown, and then during the summertime, we adjourned, and then we recently got back together, and we're meeting biweekly virtually right now. And we have, you know, all units of government represented, the schools, you know, the county, the city. We have a medical community represented, and basically we're just, you know, we're trying to let the residents know. And it's a lot more than just Hammond residents watching that, but we're just trying to reiterate, you know, what's expected, you know, what's not allowed, what events are not happening, what events are happening. And we get literally thousands of views on each of those videos we make. So I think it's an effective way to communicate with your residents.
It seems to be about the best way to do it, with the Zoom meetings, to be sure, which I know is how one of many meetings that you have to have these days. Task force is just one of them. And probably city council meetings are about the same, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I had a council meeting the other day, Chris, where I was in the chamber, the council president was in the chamber, and eight other councilmen were on TV. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything like it. And I should have taken a picture of it, but I forgot. But it was interesting. I've never been part of a meeting like that.
And we mentioned you mentioned at the start of the conversation that you're parked out there outside the Crossroad Data Center, which is located there on the very north edge of Hammond, there along Lake Michigan. And you had a chance to do certainly some in-person tours and the like, probably during some progress in construction as well as now that it's open for business. What are your thoughts as to what the prospects are, even though kind of the pandemic's gotten in the way of the organization being able to pick up business and really go fire, basically, with the opportunities for all the data processing that can happen there?
Yeah. Well, you know, in a weird way, the pandemic has helped, you know, show the importance of the data center industry, because the more we go to e-learning, the more we go to self-driving cars, the more we go to streaming video and, you know, watching it from your phone or watching it from your tablet, the more of a need we have for these data centers. And so the first data center built in the state of Indiana was built in Hammond, and that's something I'm very proud of. And we are currently in discussions with Digital Crossroads, Tom Dockich, mm-hmm. about a second project that will look very similar to the first one. So obviously the first one's gone very well. So we're in discussions about a second, and then we're in discussions currently with a national tenant that's looking to invest in Hammond as well. And it's a name I don't want to reveal, but it's a name known by just about every adult in the United States of America. And they're looking to locate in Hammond as well.
That's
so
great.
I think that project's going very well.
We're talking with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. about how things are coming along in the city of Hammond these days. We just found out some of the latest involving some economic efforts that are economic development efforts, I should say, that's underway in the city of Hammond. And we know that part of economic development is making sure that city services are available to everybody, and that includes water. And that's one of the big discussions I know that you as mayor of Hammond have had with other communities, in particular with Joliet, Illinois, about helping them out. Bring us up briefly what is the situation involving the city of Hammond and Joliet and how things are coming along right now.
Thank you. I appreciate that. In fact, tonight I'm going to be in the Joliet City Hall testifying before the mayor and the city council on behalf of the city of Hammond's proposal to supply Joliet water for the next 125 years. Joliet has relied upon deep wells, aquifers, and they're projected to dry up in the 2030s and not be able to satisfy Joliet's needs for water, which is obviously very dangerous for a city the size of Joliet. So they've narrowed their choices down to two different choices. One choice is City of Chicago connecting up to Joliet and supplying Lake Michigan water to them. The other proposal is for a raw water pipeline to be shipped from through Hammond, Indiana, ship raw water to the city of Joliet, where they would build a filtration plant and sell filtered water in the Joliet area.
Mm-hmm.
So,
after this meeting takes place, where you get to talk with the Hammond City officials, city council members, and others, what's the next step after that? It's just a matter of waiting, working more things out with the city of Joliet on this?
Well, you know, Hammond is a player in the water market in the south side of Chicago. We supply filtered water to many communities currently.
Right.
This is a proposal that wouldn't even touch our filtered water at all. It would be a raw water pipeline. So there's really little downside for Hammond in this proposal if we're chosen. The problem is our proposal is a little bit more costly than it would be for Joliet to hook up to Chicago. So we have that going against us, you know. But if we're chosen, it's literally millions of dollars for Hammond residents over the next 100 years, which is, you know, obviously the more revenue streams the city has, the better they are.
One of probably the least known activities that happen in the city of Hammond, I know, is the Hammond Legal Aid Clinic. And I know that was a project that you helped get started a long time ago. What's the latest on that?
Thank you. We just opened the Hammond Legal Aid Immigration Clinic, which was a new venture. We partnered with Alfredo Estrada, well-known Northwest Indiana immigration attorney, and we contracted his services to provide pro bono legal representation to Hammond's immigration community that can't afford legal services. And we have hundreds, if not thousands, of residents, you know, DACA residents, Dreamers, living in our city right now. And mm-hmm. this is the type of clinic that can help them straighten out their immigration status. The legal aid clinic's only available to people that can't afford their own private attorney. And we've had the legal aid clinic in operation since I became mayor, and it's served over 5,000 Hammond residents with legal services, you know, anything from wills to guardianships to, you know, to divorces, custody issues, and in this case, immigration issues. So.
And it sounds like it's a very busy place, even though the pandemic is underway, that there are a lot of people that are looking for help, and the folks at the clinic are able to help them out, I would imagine.
Well, the next big push is probably going to be on landlord-tenant issues. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had these eviction stays, and a lot of the issues that the legal aid clinic deals with involve landlord-tenant disputes, and obviously we're representing the tenant, and usually the tenant's very poor, and if they're evicted, they're literally going to be homeless, so that's going to be the next push for legal aid representation. But we're real proud of the immigration clinic opening up, and, you know, the legal aid clinic is a great addition to our city.
I know even the pandemic is in the way. There are still things that are going on almost every day within the city of Hammond, and a lot of events and activities that are underway that are looking to not only promote the city of Hammond, but also to attract more businesses and residents to the city. And I know recently you took advantage of an opportunity to put a little op-ed in, I suppose, in the Chicago's Cranes Business Chicago Business Magazine and online work about the city of Hammond. Tell us a little about what you had a chance to promote to the city of Hammond in Cranes about.
Well, if you look at what's going on in Northwest Indiana, and we're the front doorstep to Northwest Indiana and Hammond. We're literally the front door, you know, to the region. We are getting so much interest from homeowners in Illinois that are looking to relocate into Indiana, from businesses that are trying to escape their high-tax environment, even people that are sick and tired of paying outrageous water rates. You know, we have the lowest water rates in the Midwest right here in Hammond, Indiana. You know, and for industry that uses lots of water, that's a real strong selling point. So for in Northwest Indiana, particularly in Hammond, and, you know, every chance we get to appear in the Chicago media and to try to, like, draw attention to Northwest Indiana, we do so. And it's been successful because we have a lot of, you know, Illinois companies moving through Hammond.
One thing that was mentioned recently, I know in one of your podcasts that you have on your Facebook page, it talks about a very serious problem that we know is still around us, even though the coronavirus is out there. There's still concern about people that are taking drugs and overdosing from drugs. And, of course, the fentanyl issue, which is had been kind of put aside because the virus has kind of taken front and center in all of the problems that not only first responders but hospital crews have to deal with, is dealing with overdoses. That's the situation in Hammond, and your thoughts about that.
It's scary, and I appreciate you pointing that out. On Left of Center last week, my podcast, we talked about, you know, it was more of a public service announcement of one of the things as mayor that I get is I get texted every time there's an overdose in our city. I get texted for a lot of reasons, but one of the ones I make sure I get texted on is I went to the police about 5 years ago and I said, hey, you know, I want to get a better feel for how many overdoses we have in our city.
Mm-hmm.
Can you text me whenever we have an overdose? And they said, an overdose. And I said, yeah. And they said, you mean a fatality? They said, no, an overdose. And then, of course, if there's a fatality, I want you to text me. And they said, okay, mayor. And that night I got like 3 texts.
Wow.
And I found out that most of the overdoses we're having in Hammond are not fatalities. They're being revived by Narcan. And, you know, usually they go on to live another couple days before the first responders have to show up again for another overdose. But it seems that lately, you know, we have a rash of fatalities, overdose fatalities and a rash of overdoses. And I mentioned it on the show the other day, just, you know, this is a horrible, dangerous drug, and if you know people that are taking this drug, that rely on this drug, it's going to kill them. Like the fentanyl that are, you know, people are putting into the cocaine and the heroin is killing people, and it happens in Hammond, it happens all across Northwest Indiana, it happens in Chicago, and it's, you know, it's scary. Well, you know, that's the thing about people are taking this drug, whether we like it or not, whether it's illegal or not, and right now that drug is killing people, and it's really scary. And I just wanted to say something because if there's somebody in your family that's struggling with this, it needs to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I had somebody I knew very well about a month ago, him and a friend of his did a line of cocaine each. I didn't know he did cocaine, but I found out after. But him and his friend both did a line of cocaine, and they dropped dead. right on the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. It shows that
it's a problem, and it's continuing to be a problem. As we mentioned earlier, even though the coronavirus pandemic has kind of taken over the headlines, it's still a problem. It's out there and still has to be dealt with, and it just makes things more difficult for the emergency crews, for the first responders, and for the hospitals to try to deal with.
Yes, sir. In fact, oftentimes when the first responder shows up to save the person, they do save them, and as soon as the Narcan's administered, they usually start fighting. So the person that's revived usually starts fighting with their first responder.
Yeah.
That's one of the natural instincts.
It's a
very scary situation.
Well, we'll keep track of things. We'll check the podcast from time to time and be able to know what's happening in the city of Hammond. And Mayor McDermott, thank you for spending time to talk with us here on Regionally Speaking about it, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Always, Chris. I appreciate you. I appreciate your show, and have a happy holiday. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
To all your fans.
And thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte, and our thanks to Dan Carden and Joseph Pete of the Times of Northwest Indiana and Mayor McDermott for the conversation as well. And thank you for being with us for this week.